Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. It is a truism that we are a nature of immigrants, but in our fast-changing culture, we rarely stop to think about what that really means. It means that for each one of us, the ancestors of both our parents came to America from someplace else. And whether they came across the Bering Land Bridge or much later by boat or plane, in their coming, each brought with them that part of the world they had left, and then helped to shape and were shaped by this new world. One of those who came was Hans Peter Gyllenborg Koch. In 1869, he left his native Denmark for America, then traveled from Louisiana by steamboat to disembark in Montana Territory. He stayed, and Montana changed him, and he changed Montana. His diaries and letters have been published as a book, splendid on a large scale. His great-grandson and noted fine arts letterpress printer is Peter Koch. Peter, many thanks for joining us once more on Home Ground.
Yeah, thank you.
Was your great-grandfather part of your family lore growing up?
Hans Gyllenborg Koch, or known as Peter, of course, he was part of the family lore, very present almost all the time, at least for the first 10 years of my life, because I was raised by my grandfather, his son, on Beckwith Avenue in Missoula, and grandfather would, after dinner, would smoke a cigar and tell stories about his father.
You remember any of that?
Oh, I remember most of them. They were the most important stories I had ever heard.
And what was your sense for it at the time? How did it affect you as a child?
Well, it was a grand romance, and it was full of humor. So I learned a sense of humor through my grandfather telling stories about his own father. And I think I could sense his father telling them to his son. Things that self-effacing humor of someone who endures great hardship and make great light of it.
Did it affect your sense of yourself at all as a child, who you were, what your place was in Montana, or not?
Oh, hugely, hugely. I was overwhelmed by it. I mean, there are three mountains in the state named after my ancestors. There are lakes and streets and buildings and books written, you know, not many. There are three or four books written by them. And we had a library full of their work. And so as a child, I grew up thinking, well, I had either a great destiny to perform or I was a miserable wreck. I wasn't going to measure up. That was kind of the two attitudes that it gave me.
That's a double-edged sword.
Oh, it hurt.
What about your view of Montana history? You go through school, you learn Montana history or whatever state you live in.
Yeah.
Did having those stories affect your personal sense for the history of Montana as a young person?
Yeah, it did, because the most important part of our growing up with, or my growing up with grandfather was his walks. And he would take me up the Rattlesnake, and he would point out that Lewis and Clark had walked there when they came through. And so as a child, I was wildly imagining, had a huge sense of what it was like when there were no settlers. I read the journals as a child in children's book style. There was Richard Neuberger wrote a book called, I think, No Other White Man, it was called, and it was a way for me to imagine the Missoula Valley and the Missouri and the Bitterroot and the Lolo with no people in them, and I really enjoyed that. And then, of course, my sense of history was skewed by the fact that all these generations of my family had lived through almost all of it and had their own separate stories. And so I saw Montana from a perspective of highly educated men and women, highly cultured.
We'll talk about that. Now, when did you first read your great-grandfather's diaries or letters?
I imagine it was in high school. Carl Cohn had published segments of the diary in the Mississippi Historical Journal and the Oregon Historical Journal, and these things were passed around, and of course I would read them.
Did it change anything in comparison with your childhood perceptions when you started reading what he'd written?
No, I don't think it did. It was this. They were, I think, grandfather's stories were somewhat based on Cohn's research as well, because Cohn used my grandfather as a source. So he was aware of all these letters through Cohn's research and not through his own.
I said he came up from Louisiana on a steamboat. Tell us a little about the trip.
I know that he expected to get to the Fort Benton, Montana in 35 days, he said in one of his letters. And it took him took the boat 4 months. And in those 4 months, there were they lost the ship's carpenter. They lost passengers. They had a mutiny on board, and the pilot had to be put into a jail somewhere in Sioux City. And then because the pilot came back on the boat with a gun and tried to threaten the first officer after he was discharged, and all of these delays. And then, of course, if they didn't find enough meat, they had to stay where they were. And, you know, there's all these mentions in his diary of hunting and not finding something.
How did that strike him? I mean, you said he was your family was educated, cultivated. He himself was a college graduate. He was an educated urban guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, oh, very much so.
How does that experience, and does it show up in his letters or diaries, an urban reaction to that sort of frontier existence?
He did say in a number of places in his letters that he was afraid that he was roughening up, that his edges were getting severely bumped and ground, and that he was feeling that he might not be the man that he once was. But at the same time, I think obviously a slow acculturation to the life on the frontier, you know, did toughen him up a lot.
But that's an interesting thing. If he wrote that he might be losing what he was. Many people, I think, coming from an urbanized, sophisticated, and in some sense protected environment, might have felt inadequate for the potential physical aspect of coping with this. Is there any indication that he ever questioned his own competence to deal with what he was coming into?
Never. I could tell that he was a really confident man. He attacked every problem that he could find. He had a lot of bad luck. When as a woodchopper on the Missouri in 69, 70, he would lose his entire season's work because a Sioux Indian gang would show up and burn all the wood, and he would lose it all. But he would just say, well, that's how it goes out here, and go back to chopping again.
Okay, so he's had this four-month trip. He arrives. What does he find?
Well, would this be an appropriate place to quote him?
Absolutely.
The settlement and surrounding desolate sagebrush-covered plain did not usually offer many points of interest to the travelers on the steamboats, except the usual features of a village on the extreme frontier, here perhaps somewhat exaggerated. But when the Huntsville landed, there at the time referred to, a sight met her passengers which was certainly calculated to shock the nerves of any eastern tenderfoot. Along the brink of the river bank, on both sides of the landing, a row of stakes was planted, and each stake carried a white, grinning Indian skull. They were evidently the pride of the inhabitants, and a little to one side, as if guarding them, stood a trapper, well known throughout eastern Montana by the sobriquet of Liver-Eaten Johnson. He was leaning on a crutch, with one leg bandaged, and the day being hot, his entire dress consisted in a scant, much shrunken, red undershirt, reaching just below his hips. His matted hair and bushy beard fluttered in the breeze, and his giant frame and limbs, so freely exposed to view, formed an exceedingly impressive and characteristic picture. But while the exhibition of these skulls did not indicate any high degree of civilization on the part of the inhabitants, the manner in which they had been procured showed at least that they possessed the courage and the enterprise so necessary in the dangerous and exposed life led by them.
We are talking with Peter Koch about a recently published book of letters and diaries written by his great-grandfather, Hans Peter Gimmelburg Koch. The book is titled Splendid on a Large Scale. How old was he when he arrived in Montana?
He was 25. He'd left Denmark when he was 21, spent a couple of years, quote, knocking about the East, a series of really rotten jobs. And when he spent a year in Bokoma, and then when he was 25, he hit the frontier, 24, 25.
Now, that description that you just read graphically displays that the Indian Wars were very much alive in Montana and their brutality. What was his attitude toward the Indians?
Well, he had mixed attitude. He, in general, thought of them as uncivilized savages who were probably in need of a considerable amount of Europeanization. At the same time, he created some friendships when he was trading in the Judith Basin with some of the Crow Indians, whom he did admire some of the Indians, but he, in general, he was, he didn't like suffering them.
Was he personally involved? He's now arrived in the Muscle Shell. Was he personally involved in the Indian Wars?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the passages in his diary, which was a very small little notebook he kept, describes that. I quote from Peter's journal in 1870 on July 4th. About 12 o'clock, Joe Olson and Brady came across the river and were attacked. Joe and Brady made our stockade while Olson was left behind and had to hang himself by the arms over the bank. We all rushed out, and the Indians were firing at us from just behind Lee's stockade and the newest cottonwood trees and all through the sagebrush. The balls whistled pretty lively over our heads, but we returned the fire with interest and soon drove them from their shelter, on which we fired about a half a dozen shells. They kept hovering around the hills on the other side of the Muscle Shell, and we shelled them every now and then. We went out and found one young warrior killed by a shot through the upper part of his thigh. He was hit with a Spencer ball and must have been shot by Lewis or me. We got his gun, bow, arrows, and two butcher knives and threw his body into the river. Waring scalped him.
You said he later traded with the Indians. Is there anything in his diary about that?
Well, there is a letter that he wrote back to Louisiana in January of 1874 describing the fort and trading post that he built in the Judith Basin. And I can quote from that.
Please.
I must return from my walk, as I did yesterday, most unwillingly. The different groups of mountains were beautiful with their ragged outlines sharply defined against the clear sky. But when I got in sight of the fort, I could see an unusual stir around it and a number of horses, and I hurried in to see and welcome my red friends. About 25 Indians, bucks and squaws, had come in, led by Horse Guard, head chief of the River Crows. I went into my office, and there he was, sitting, smoking, and shook hands with him. He is a great friend to the whites. He has a fine, intelligent face, and is one of the best Indians in every respect that I know. I had hardly had time to hand up my rifle and belt before four bucks came in and presented me with a robe each. Now, if you think that a present from an Indian is a desirable thing, you're mistaken. You take his present, say, "Itzik, good," and put it away. The Indian goes about his business, but before he leaves your place, he will want a little more than the value of the present in return, and he is not at all backward in saying what he wants. Now and then you will find an exception, but this is the rule. By the way, my name is no longer Peter Koch. I have given that name to a young buck and got his in return, Chenish, or the Rider, with the ch sounded hard and guttural. Or, if you don't like it like that, I have another one, Masa Chela Shena Katat, the yellow, fair-haired white man.
Amazing. Is there anything else like this? This is so firsthand, so direct, on the spot, I just think it must be extraordinary.
I think it's unique, to my knowledge, because most of the documents that come from that same period are reminiscences. The reminiscences of Granville Stewart, the reminiscences of Teddy Blue Abbott, they were all collected later in life. These are actually on the spot, written out in longhand and put in a mail down on a riverboat and headed to Louisiana. So Brian Shovers, a historian at the Historical Society, has said it might be one of the real prime documents of the period firsthand.
Plus, it's highly literate, which has got to make it even more extraordinary. One aspect of trade with Indians was liquor. Was he involved in that aspect at all?
Actually, he was not. Peter was very much against the idea of alcohol in the Indian civilization. He saw plenty of it. He even remarked about the difference between the River Crow and the Mountain Crow. And he said it was really, you could tell the difference between the two civilizations because the River Crow drank and the Mountain Crow wouldn't allow liquor into their camps. And he remarked on it. And then later he even wrote down the recipe for this stuff that is referred to as whiskey. And I can read it. The recipe goes like this. 1 quart alcohol, 1 pound rank black chewing tobacco, 1 handful red peppers, 1 bottle Jamaica ginger, 1 quart black molasses, and water from the Missouri. Mix well and boil till all the strength is drawn from the tobacco and the peppers.
Unbelievable. So what were his goals when he got there? What did he want to do?
Well, I think fairly strong in his mind was that he was always envisioning a homestead, a farm, and raising vegetables and flowers. He was a man who wanted a library, a frame house, a big garden, and a prominent vista. You know, he just loved that idea.
And how did it work out for him? First, he had to make money to develop that, right? You said he chopped wood commercially. So what did he do for work?
Well, his first the first thing he did is he skinned wolves, chopped wood to sell to riverboats, and kept the store for Clendenin at Fort Musselshell. That lasted about 2 years. He never made a dime. Couldn't save anything. He lost it all. Hmm. His second attempt at making a living was to try and get on with scientific expeditions to Yellowstone Park and big major government surveys as a surveyor. He was trained as a surveyor. He only got one survey job down in the Deer Lodge Valley. That didn't pan out. Hmm. His third attempt at making a living was to become what they called the sutler at the Fort Keogh outside of Bozeman, which he did for about a year or less. And then he met some people in Bozeman and got hired on as a storekeeper in downtown Bozeman by the big store family that owned the store. Mm-hmm. And from there, he succeeded in business by making good connections, and eventually he connected with Nelson Story, and Story had opened a bank and hired Peter as his cashier, and that was the beginning of his long career of banking.
Is that the same Story family that Pete Story is a member, or former member of the Montana
Absolutely.
Legislature? Absolutely.
Nelson Story was the paterfamilias up from Texas with cattle.
So it sounds like then he never got the farm.
That's right. He failed utterly at that. He kept after it and after it and after it. But by the time he finally had enough money to possibly have a farm, he was so completely involved in the business mm-hmm. of downtown Bozeman and of the state that there was no time for that.
Who did he marry and when?
Well, he married a woman. Her name is Lorenza Koch. Lori, the youngest daughter of his uncle, who had come to the United States in the 1830s from Denmark. He met her in Louisiana in her home when he was working for his uncle, courted her for 5 years, which is the source of all these letters because he wrote them to her, and then eventually 5 years later he brought her up to Bozeman and they built a house.
Although he was an urban guy, he was clearly affected by the landscape. I want to read something I read from that book, and I guess it goes to the title of the book. "You have no idea how much there is in this wild life that I enjoy. The sense of freedom one has out here when one gets up, where he can look around for 100 miles and not see his neighbor's smoke, is perfectly splendid. Some mornings when I'm riding all alone, I cannot help putting my mare at a gallop and singing loud."
I love that passage.
So then what does he do? He's successful commercially, lives in town. What does he do?
Well, his passions were building libraries and creating an educational system in Bozeman. So he and one other gentleman evidently were the founder of the first library in Bozeman. It was a free library, and he was always collecting books, even on the Musselshell. And then his second passion was education. He had a lot of strong opinions about it, and he fought with several other gentlemen in Bozeman for the placement of the Montana State College at the time in Bozeman, and then he was treasurer of the college, and actually some say he was more politically strong in the college than the president of the university. He took a serious interest in it.
We are talking with Peter Koch about a book of letters and diaries written by his great-grandfather called Splendid on a Large Scale. Now, in the book, is there detailed discussion of why he cared about education, why he cared about literature, why he would found a library? Is any of that discussed?
No. This is the book is just the letters from 69 to 74.
Ah.
So what I know about his personal interest in is all from family lore.
So what's the source, or what are the sources for what is known about his role in Montana and Bozeman and the impact he had?
The primary sources of that for me have always been Merrill Burlingame, who wrote about him, who was a prominent historian at Bozeman, and Carlton Cone wrote about him, and also the histories of Montana State College have been written, and he usually figures in the first chapter as the founder and some of his philosophy of education, which was very, very practical.
What do you mean?
Peter was educated in theory and Greek and Latin and geography and so forth, and I think that his professors at the University of Copenhagen were deeply influenced by Alexander von Humboldt. And von Humboldt was an explorer and a scientist and a general natural scientist. So Peter was deeply inflected with that kind of learning, wanted the people on the frontier, mm-hmm. the kids growing up in Weibo and Plentywood, to have an opportunity to be exposed to scientific thought, engineering, the principles of clear and critical thinking about the natural world. He was less interested in them learning theology. He himself had been a student of theology, but he figured that that was to be taken care of in the church and not in the university.
It's a very interesting, I mean, just listening to this story brings out a completely different aspect of Montana and Western history than I'm used to thinking about. I mean, it's cowboys, Indians, the settlement, the rugged individualist, etc. Mm-hmm. This is early stuff of a guy who's a sophisticated man who comes and has an influence that I don't know if it's a word, enculturates this new territory. Fair?
Yes, and up to a point. I think that his educational views were against the flow of what was immediately to come. For instance, he was determined that liberal arts education was to be a part of a scientific education, which has gone by the wayside to some degree now. Then he thought it was important. In fact, he is quoted as saying to his son, not in the diaries, but he used to say to my grandfather that knowing Greek and Latin made him a better woodchopper on the Missouri. And I think he felt that that was important for the culture of the state, that he believed in it.
Clearly, with his commitment to libraries and education, that he had very strong views. The point I was making, perhaps inadequately, was there's a different, what he and those like him did is seems to me to be not emphasized in our common sense of Montana history. You agree or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, you know, there's a great Helena tycoon who was one of the best book collectors in the entire United States, and his collection is not even known about in Montana. It resides in Los Angeles, and I challenge you to find someone who knows anything about it. It was the Kessler collection, and it lives in the Clark Library in Los Angeles. No one's written about it, no books, no essays, no articles.
Now, you were involved in this book. How so?
Well, in 1991, I started collecting the essays that were written about him by historians. And probably by 1994, I had contacted Rick Newby here in Helena to ask him if we couldn't work together on publishing the letters.
This book is a Drumlummon book?
Yes, Drumlummon and Bedrock Editions collaboration.
So you help precipitate the publication of the book, and did you, any other aspect of your involvement?
I not only precipitated it, but I also had all the letters transcribed in Louisiana and then handed them over to Rick to look at. And then I'm the person that found the editor, or the editor found me, whichever way you want to look at it. But I was in Bozeman doing more research on Peter Koch, and I met the editor, Kim Allen Scott, who was the librarian there, and I probably complained to him that I was having trouble finding the funding to get it well edited, and Kim brightened up when he heard that and looked at me and said, "Well, Peter," he says, "I am paid to do things like that." And I said, "Well, would you do it?" And he said, "Well, I would be glad to." And so I handed him the job, basically, and he did it with great pleasure. In addition to providing the impetus and some of the primary research, I wrote a chapter of the book, and the chapter is titled Unpacking My Great-Grandfather's Library, and it is really an appreciation of Peter Koch's book collecting and then the fact that I collected the library from his grandson, Thomas Koch, and brought it to my home in California. And the collection and writing about it is a great pleasure to me because I was raised in a house that was more a library and a museum than a cook stove. And I lived there amongst these books, and it's formed my whole character, I think. And then eventually I came into possession of them. Peter was an amazingly perceptive collector. He collected books before there were lists to tell you what books to collect about the country in which he lived. And he specialized in the Louisiana Purchase, the history of, and the history of the Upper Missouri, the geology, and the exploration, the scientific exploration is what he specialized in. Not so much the Rip Snorton narratives, and the Luke Short books, but the scientific expeditions, the Lewis and Clark specialty, Bodmer. And then, of course, the story of the Indians.
How big a collection are we talking about?
At the time that he was collecting, and it was thought to be one of the four great collections in the United States, in private hands on the subject. So it was big. And it's not big in a lot of ways because there weren't that many books. I have roughly 250 books.
But and it was kept in the family all that time. That's unusual in itself.
It's unheard of.
If I understood you correctly, you said the origin of this book arose in part because you were doing a research on him. You're not a young man. That suggests to me that clearly this guy continues to have serious influence over you. Fair?
Absolutely fair. And I'm still exploiting and trying to discover what it all means. My last two major artworks are related directly to the collection and directly to the whole theory of what I learned from living in this family.
And those artworks are?
Well, the first is a show called and portfolio called Nature Mort, which is a museum of the destruction of the West.
We did a show about that.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, okay.
And the second one, the newest one, is a collaboration between Deborah Magpie Erling and myself. Deborah having written a long poem from the point of view of Sacagawea, traveling up the Missouri in 1804, a pregnant girl with a group of Martians, as far as she would know.
Sure.
And she has a different perspective on the whole shebang.
And you, as a fine artist letterpress printer, have designed the book and...
Right. I did that and added the images. And all the images are from historic photographs, but I'm calling them photo interventions because those photographs have been seriously plucked out of their environment and placed in a situation in which it changes the meaning of these things deeply or inflects them.
You say you're still working out what your great-grandfather's legacy in life means to you. What have you found so far?
The only thing that I've really found that has influenced me to a major extent is that my vision of the West is almost a realism that is painful and dark. And I don't readily go there, but when I do, I find that it is really illuminating and finally enlightening. I think the darkness up the upper Missouri has a great deal of meaning to be cared for. That's probably what it is. I want to care for what it is that that book and our lives are based on.
Peter Koch, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is a production of Artemis Common Ground, which is solely responsible for the views expressed. Carmen Mowbray is our producer. Contact us at P.O. Box 748, Helena, Montana, 59624, or visit us on the web at homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, High Stakes, Norcross Wildlife Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communications about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.